For years, I've been bragging on the team at Allied Outdoor Solutions in Houston for the beautiful work they do to make your outdoor area, your backyard, look like a resort. Well, their business has just grown and grown organically because they do great work. Your walkways, the area around your pool, your outdoor kitchen, all of that. AlliedOutdoorSolutions.com. And now, over the years, it's taken 20 years, they're now in Austin, Dallas, and San Antonio. AlliedOutdoorSolutions.com. 844-846-1010. Call them at 844-846-1010.
I have a buddy named Ray Briers, and he owns a company called The Pipe Yard Inc., INC.com. And if you have a project that needs carbon steel pipe, he stocks everything you need. New surplus, secondary, you name it. Rat hole, mouse hole, conductor casing, pipe pile, sign pole, structural, road bores, dredging. If you're buying or selling, you got an abandoned pipeline, wherever, he'll buy it. ThePipeYardInc.com. 409-788-PIPE. 409-788-PIPE.
It's that time. Time. Lock and load. The Michael Berry Show is on the air.
We spent a good portion of the morning show today, and I'm not going to do that this evening, but I say it because I think many of you might be interested, talking about a law that just passed in Texas that allows college athletes to be compensated for their NIL, is what it's called, their name, image, and likeness. And apparently the biggest opportunity, at least so far, is for college athletes to be able to post a tweet or Instagram or Facebook or whatever else that says they drink Coca-Cola or they do this or they do this. But it would allow them for the first time to be compensated, which opens a lot of interesting doors, whether you think that's a good idea or a bad idea, and the role of the university generally in the life of America. That was the subject of our morning show. If you missed it, you can go to the podcast. I'm not going to cover it this evening. In fact, we got more than we can get to this evening, but you can go to our podcast, as you can with any show. It was a discussion that I think a lot of folks are going to be interested in. How much is the athletic program even a part of the university? Why should we give scholarships to college athletes? Why should we have to beg them to graduate? Is that so important? And a number of other questions. I don't want to do that now, and I'm liable to because I'm interested in it. But I hope you find that interesting on the podcast. I will tell you real quickly what we're going to be doing on the show today, and that is first we're going to talk to Jack Phillips. You probably don't know the name Jack Phillips, but I bet you do know what Masterpiece Cake Shop is. In 2012, two men walked into his cake shop and said, "We want a wedding cake. We're getting married." He said, "I'll make you any other kind of cake, but I can't make a wedding cake. It's against my values. I also don't make Halloween cakes. I don't make cakes for Satan. I don't make cakes denying the Holocaust and all sorts of other things. I have certain values. They happen to be religious. I can't make you a wedding cake because that would mean I condone gay weddings, and I don't." He wasn't hateful. He wasn't discriminatory. He didn't go bash them. He didn't go to their neighborhood. He didn't write nasty things on the bathroom wall about them. They sued him. He lost, and he lost, and he lost at each level until he went to the Supreme Court, and he won. But it cost him a lot, personally and financially. He's written a book called The Cost of My Faith, and he talks about his case and how it changed his life and affected his business. In fact, he's still being harassed to this day. In fact, we did the interview a couple of hours ago, and 5 minutes before our interview started, his lawyer was on the phone with us, and his lawyer got an update in the case where he's being sued by a private attorney because he won't make a cake that has a picture of Satan smoking pot because he also doesn't approve of that. And so they're just harassing this man, and we'll give you the update on that. That will be our discussion for the next three segments. And after that, we will take up a topic that's not necessarily specifically in the news today, but it's a trend topic, and I like to do these. You have to realize that sometimes I like to have people on, not necessarily because I believe 100% of their position, but because I think these are conversations you and I and families and people should be having. Greg Ellis is an actor. He was in Pirates of the Caribbean. He was in 24. He was in Dexter. He's been in over 100 movies, films, cartoons, done voiceover work. But in this case, he's written a book called The Respondent, and it's about exposing the cartel of family law, as he calls it. And he believes that because of the antipathy toward men, which we call toxic masculinity, that men are not getting a fair shake when they go to family courts today, if it is a case between them and their wife and who gets custody and who pays what. And he makes a pretty powerful argument, and he shares his perspective on that, and that will take up the entirety of our next hour. And I think not just men, but some women may find that very interesting as well. I hope you'll just keep an open mind, something to think about. Sometimes maybe the pendulum swings too far in the way that we had too many drunk driving accidents in this country that were killing innocent people. So we passed drunk driving laws that in many cases don't even affect drunk driving. We passed open container laws. We started throwing people in jail for having a couple of drinks and blowing hot when their driving wasn't even bad. They were stopped for a taillight that was out. And so, in a sense, we're in a constant challenge to try to be reasonable. But there's always one side winning out, and so we lurch back and forth, don't we? But before we get to that, in my opinion, the most disturbing news of the day involves the son of President Joe Biden. That, of course, is Hunter Biden. The United States has been the strongest nation on earth, but that doesn't mean that other nations like Russia and China do not constantly, in a well-orchestrated, sophisticated, relentless campaign, attempt to undermine us. And we are relatively easily undermined because the weaknesses of the people who occupy top positions are exposed to the very, very subtle, sophisticated efforts of foreign governments and foreign entities to undermine them. You've got an obvious weak spot with Joe Biden in his son, Hunter Biden. Well-documented, well-photographed drug addiction problems. Making babies he doesn't raise. He denies paternity with strippers. Behaviors that are pretty ugly. Leaving a laptop with all sorts of evidence against him and his father. With all sorts of emails and foreign business dealings. He has very expensive tastes. He likes expensive designer drugs. He likes expensive women. He likes expensive travel and cars and all sorts of other things. And, oh, by the way, he doesn't have a day job. So how does Hunter Biden get paid? For that matter, how does Joe Biden, over all those years, afford all of the expensive things he owns when the only thing he's ever done was be a United States senator and then vice president, and neither one of those pay well enough to afford multi-million dollar homes? Well, we know he's the big guy in the emails. Bobulinski affirmed or confirmed. Yeah, he's the big guy. If you're going to bribe Joe Biden, Hunter Biden, the point of the bribe is not Hunter Biden. He can't do anything. Hunter Biden is only useful insofar as he can get his father to do something as vice president or president. So now we learn that Hunter Biden is selling his art. He's an artist now. Selling his art for upwards of $500,000. Well, who in the world is buying that? Because that's going to tell us a lot. Is it the Chinese government, the Russian government? Who is it? Is it somebody that wants a contract? Is it somebody that wants a pipeline? Is it somebody that wants a presidential pardon? Well, you don't get to know because they're not telling us. They're anonymous. So these bribes for his art. Now, why his art? Because if they bought his car or his house or his clothes, there's a market value for things, and it would be obvious it's a bribe. But it's art. It's subjective. It could be the invisible sculpture that recently sold. So maybe Hunter Biden's art's really valuable. Maybe it's worth $500,000 or $5 million or $50 million. Who are you to question? Well, it's the job of the press to question, to report. But, of course, they can't do that. They have to protect Joe Biden. Because Joe Biden is the alternative to your choice, whether that be Donald Trump or Ron DeSantis or Ted Cruz or whoever that might be in the future and has been in the past. The only way the left can win is to cover for Joe Biden. So even if he's being bribed through his son for $500,000 junks of art, who are they to question? You got to keep this ball rolling. Things are going great in America. At least we don't have Trump as president. right?
Michael Berry Show.
Well, I won't back down. No, I won't.
If I were to ask you to name a cake shop in this country, if I were to ask you to name a cake shop outside the city you live in, you may be able to name one in your city. I guess I would start with Three Brothers Bakery. Wonderful. Three Jewish brothers, post-World War II, created a great bakery. They did our wedding cake. There's Mueller's, which makes great little pétifours. I could think of a few more. But outside of my own city, there's literally only one place that makes cakes in the country that I can think of, at least a local cake shop. And not because their cakes are awesome. I'm sure they are, but I don't know if their cakes are any good. I know that a guy who was making cakes, is there anything more wholesome? Did that sound like a lot of fun? I know that a guy that was making cakes had two guys walk in and ask him to make a wedding cake, a custom wedding cake for their same-sex wedding. And he said, I cannot in good conscience do that. And by choosing not to do that, he thrust himself into a major political situation where he became a football for lots of other people. He went all the way to the Supreme Court. He won, losing it every step of the way before that. It changed his life, I'm sure. He's written a book about it. That was 2012, and 9 years later, I can still tell you about the Masterpiece Cake Shop. And I bet you remember that name as well. Well, Jack Phillips is his name. He makes the cakes. He made the decision. And the book is The Cost of My Faith, How a Decision in My Cake Shop Took Me to the Supreme Court. So, Jack, why not just make the cake?
Well, thank you for having us today. The question is a good question, and I've thought about it many times. People ask me all the time, and my answer is that a wedding cake has an inherent message. And while I serve everybody who comes in my shop, I can't create every cake with every message. And a wedding cake, I say, has an inherent message. You walk into a conference room at a hotel and you see a wedding cake on a corner in the room, you don't have to ask if it's a business meeting. You know automatically that it's a wedding. And so I couldn't create a cake that celebrated a same-sex marriage.
And did you have to think about that? Had you been asked this question before? I mean, was this something that you'd thought through before, or you realized that at the moment?
We had actually been had that request three or four times before that. But beyond that, before my wife and I opened the shop, we sat down and we talked about which kind of cakes we would create, which kind of cakes we could not. Those cakes included Halloween cakes. We decided not to create those. Cakes that were anti-American or racist or insulted or denigrated other people. And way back in 91, 92, when we were discussing these things, we opened in 93. We even talked about same-sex marriage, even though it was on nobody's radar. It's like, that's a wedding that we can't celebrate, so we knew we wouldn't do that. And so we had already drawn those lines, and the Halloween thing comes up every year, so we had practice on saying as graciously as we can, I'm sorry, that's a cake that we can't create for you. So when this one came up, we were ready for it and knew our response.
So it bears noting, just to repeat what you've said, you don't just make cakes and put them out there and people buy them, and whatever they want, you make them. This is part of your value system. There are things that you don't do. Look, you'd make more money if you sold Halloween cakes. You would have made money if you sold a cake here. This is an important part of your value system. Somebody doesn't have to agree with that, but that's your prerogative. That's your privilege, and people should respect that, right?
Yeah, my faith in Jesus Christ compels all my actions. It directs the way I treat my wife, my family, my customers, as well as which cakes I can create, which messages I'll express, and which ones I can't. Every American should be free to live and work according to their conscience without fear of punishment from the government. And in this case, the government came after me because I declined to create a cake that the Civil Rights Commission felt that I should.
So looking at your website and looking at some of your work, the term masterpiece should tell me this, but it's clear you're an actual artist. You're not just drawing things with icing. I mean, you're actually painting on there. Is mm-hmm. that your background? Is artistry or baking? What do you do better?
I'm an artist first. That was my background going through school and all. And then when I graduated, I needed a job. Got a job in a large bakery and fell in love with baking. And then the owner of it brought in cake decorators, and I thought, that's my future. I knew what it was going to be. And I knew even way back then, back in the 70s, that it would be a cake shop, that the name would be Masterpiece Cake Shop, because Masterpiece says art, Cake Shop says cakes, and the cakes mm-hmm. would then be my canvas where I could help people celebrate the important events in their life.
Well, not everybody's going to buy art, but we all need cakes. So it sounds like that was a good
decision. You're right.
And there you were on that fateful day. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, it was a beautiful day back in July of 2012. I'm working in the back of my shop, had a couple girls working out front. They were both busy, so when I noticed that there were two men sitting at our wedding desk, I went out to greet them and see if I could serve them. You might think, two men at the wedding desk, I should have sent up red flags, but they could be looking for an anniversary cake for their parents or something, you know, two brothers or whatever. So I went out, introduced myself, and one of them said, you know, they gave me their names, and one of them said, we're here to look at wedding cakes. The other one said, it's for our wedding. And so I knew right away what my response to that would be, that I couldn't create a cake that went against my faith. I just didn't know how I would say it or what they would, how they would take it. So I said, sorry, guys, I don't create cakes for same-sex weddings. They just kind of stared at me, and I said, I'll sell you birthday cakes, shower cakes, cookies, brownies. I just can't create a cake for a same-sex wedding, hoping for more conversation. But immediately one of them jumped up, flipped me off, and stormed out the door swearing. And the other one gathered up a folder that they had with their cake ideas and went out the other door. And I was stunned. It, you know, they didn't give me a chance to discuss these things. But I felt in that sentence or two, you know, I'll make you other custom work. I'll sell you anything in the store. It's not you or your orientation. It's the cake that I can't create because I serve everybody. I just can't create every message.
You think it was a setup?
In this case, I do not. I know that the case that we're in now, our third case, is definitely a setup. It was an attorney who called us multiple times, right up 2 weeks after these two men stormed out of my shop back in 2012. We'd gotten emails from this attorney, and then later on a call asking us to create a cake of Satan smoking marijuana, and then a cake that was blue on the outside and pink on the inside to celebrate a gender transition. And so we told this person also, you know, we'll create other cakes for you, but that's a cake with a message we can't express. And so this person filed a complaint with the state of Colorado. The state picked that one up. That one we call Masterpiece 2. And then Masterpiece 3 is after the state dismissed those charges. This attorney is still coming after us and suing us in civil court.
Do you have any regrets? By the way, the book is called The Cost of My Faith, How a Decision in My Cake Shop Took Me to the Supreme Court by Jack Phillips. It's out now. Do you have any regrets? And what was the cost of your faith?
You know, initially the Civil Rights Commission, I have no regrets, but the Civil Rights Commission required me to change my policies and start creating wedding cakes for same-sex couples or anybody who came in, and I wouldn't even be able to get to help design that cake. If they wanted to create a cake that had an adult theme or even a pornographic theme, I would just have to say, yes, what do you want, when do you want it? And that's not right. Everybody should be free to live and work according to their conscience, and the government shouldn't be able to force us to create action, to create messages like that. So we were forced to give up our wedding business, which was a huge part of our business at that time, and we're still fighting that. Like I say, we're still in court, but would I change my mind or make another decision? Absolutely not.
So you still can't create wedding cakes at your shop?
While we're still in litigation, we're not creating wedding cakes, correct?
Wow. Well, I mean, I don't know what percentage of your business that is, but you're having to
lose money. It was
a large
part.
Wow.
I went from 10 employees the day that the two men came in down to 4 at one point, including myself. And so it was fairly, you know, we had death threats. We had hateful emails by the hundreds or thousands, phone calls that were horrific. I started answering the phone all the time from that day forward so that my employees didn't have to face this stuff that's directed at me, not them.
Even though the Supreme Court ruled in favor of Masterpiece Cake Shop, the harassment of this man and his business continues. In fact, there was a new ruling in a new case against him today. I'll tell you all about it coming up next.
The Michael Berry Show.
Allied Outdoor Solutions has been a show sponsor of ours in our Houston flagship market for almost 20 years now. And it's been fun because they've gone from just a handful of folks to growing and growing and growing, doing beautiful backyard solutions to make your backyard, your front yard, your side yard, your front driveway look like a resort. And over the years, they've added Austin, San Antonio, Dallas. And what the work they do, you can see it for yourself at AlliedOutdoorSolutions.com or have them come do it for you. 844-846-1010. 844-846-1010. Your car breaks down over time, and so do we. Your joints ache. It's hard getting old. We know this. TheTrustedLab.com helps me. I lead a more active lifestyle than I ever have, and I feel better than ever. Delivered to my doorstep, completely legal, lab-tested CBD, TheTrustedLab.com, based right here in Texas, TheTrustedLab.com.
I hear people talking bad about the way we have to live here in this country. Harping on wars we fight and griping about the way things ought to be.
We're talking to Jack Phillips. He's the owner of Masterpiece Cake Shop. He was dragged into court 9 years ago for refusing to make a cake that violated his values. And the harassment against him continues. Nevertheless, he has no regrets. We continue our conversation with him. So these people that preach love and peace and kindness and tolerance can be very, very nasty. And you're in a town called Loveland, Colorado, although I'm guessing these
Lakewood,
calls weren't coming from
the suburb of Denver.
Oh. Where
yeah,
are you?
Some websites say Loveland, and that's a community north of us about an hour, but we're in Lakewood, which is across the street from Denver.
Oh, okay. All right. I was going to ask you. I'm in Colorado right now. I live in Houston, but we're in Colorado right now. I was going to ask you where it was and if it was close enough, come buy a cake. I may end up coming buying a cake anyway. But when we talk about the cost of your faith, right? So you had to lay off 6 employees. You can't do your wedding business. Talk to me about the things you can't put a dollar sign on.
Well, for one thing, going into this trial, we had to go through deposition, which a lot of people, I didn't understand what deposition is, but it's where the opposing attorney has, in this case, up to 6 hours to basically cross-examine you and try and twist your words and trap you and make you say something you don't intend and then discredit you, destroy your credibility. And not only did I have to go through that twice, I had to watch my wife go through that. And like, I'm on camera so they could see me, make sure I'm not signaling her or anything like that, but I just have to sit there and watch this man attack my wife. And then when we were in the trial, the same thing with the taking a witness stand. Both my wife and my daughter had to take the witness stand. But we also had somebody there who took the witness stand in our favor, and I met him a few years ago. He came into the shop on a day that a local radio station wanted to broadcast from our shop all day long, and the first person to come in introduced himself, said, "My name is Mike, and I'm a gay man, and I just came to find out what's going on." "Well, hey, Mike, how are you? You know, what can I do for you?" We talked a little bit. He came back, and we've since become friends, and I say he even testified on our behalf at the trial that we just went through.
Well, and to be clear, you'll be glad to make a cake about football or soccer or
graduation
for this fellow.
You know, birthdays, yeah, Christmas, all kinds of those things. But there are certain cakes that convey messages that I can't express. And the same-sex wedding was one, and a cake celebrating a gender transition, a change from a male to a female, man to a woman, is a cake that I can't create a celebration to help celebrate.
I dare say nobody that's doing this to you would believe that an atheist should be required to make a cake that says Jesus is Lord, and if they refuse to, these same folks in government and politics and activism wouldn't prosecute them or persecute them either.
I don't know, but I can't see that happening. So nobody should be forced to express a message that goes against their faith. And the government
should. Let's bring in Ryan Bangert. He's senior counsel for Alliance Defending Freedom. These are folks who step in and, well, I'll tell you what, Ryan, what do you folks do and how does this case fit within this? Why did y'all get involved in this?
You bet. So Alliance Defending Freedom is one of the nation's largest nonprofit organizations that defends constitutional rights, free speech, and religious liberty, and really exists to keep the door open for the gospel. And Jack's case is one that fits squarely within that mission. Jack is an artisan, really. He's a small businessman, but he's also an artisan, as he's already described. And the cakes that he creates communicate messages. And in this case, actually in all of his cases, the folks who are challenging his right to communicate messages that reflect his beliefs and his faith are trying to use the power of the state to coerce them to say things that conflict with his deeply held beliefs. And that's absolutely wrong. It contradicts the Constitution. It contradicts our first freedoms enshrined in the First Amendment. And that's a core part of ADF's message, to defend people like Jack, who simply want to live their lives, serve their customers, but don't want to be forced by the government to speak words and communicate messages that directly conflict with their deeply held beliefs and their conscience. And that's exactly what we've been doing for Jack throughout. The first case, the one that went all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court, the Supreme Court held that the Colorado Commission had demonstrated hostility to Jack's religious beliefs and had required him to do something that conflicted with his conscience because they were analogizing his faith to discrimination, which was abhorrent and wrong. And the Supreme Court absolutely got it right in calling that out. But even in this latest case, Jack was requested by an individual to create a cake that expressed a message about, in that case it was transgenderism, and Jack simply couldn't create that cake. He couldn't communicate that message because it conflicted with his faith. And we just recently got the order, actually just today, from the court, holding that Jack was required by Colorado law to bake that cake. So we are going to appeal. We're going to take that back up, just like we did the previous case. And we're confident that we'll win on appeal, because no one, no artisan, no one who holds a deeply held religious belief should be forced by the state to speak words and communicate messages that conflict with those beliefs. That's fundamentally wrong and contrary to the First Amendment. And that's one of the reasons why ADF exists, to defend people like Jack against those kinds of overreaches and encroachments by the state.
Ryan, does ADF take cases outside a religious defense? What if this was simply a person who said, it's not a religious belief, but I don't want to take a vaccine? Or it's not a religious belief, mm-hmm. but I don't want to do this? Or or do y'all strictly focus on cases based on faith?
You know, we certainly do take cases focusing on faith, but that's not all we do. We have a number of attorneys who represent students and professors in colleges and universities whose speech is infringed by various college policies or rules. And not all of those infringements involve religious speech. Sometimes it's political speech. Sometimes it's just conscientious speech. So, no, we don't just limit our representation to cases involving religious faith messages that are being either coerced or squelched. We cover a pretty broad portfolio of things.
The group that represented Jack Phillips, because he couldn't have afforded the legal representation of all these years, it would have put him out of business. We're going to talk more with him coming up next.
This is the Michael Berry Show.
Yeah, that's the one.
Yeah.
Talking to Jack Phillips, Masterpiece Cake Shop, about his experience. Since 9 years ago, he was dragged to court and made it all the way to the Supreme Court to win more rights for you and me and our religious beliefs and anyone else. That case continues even to this day, or the harassment. We continue our conversation with him. When you look at the continued persecution of this man and his business for his beliefs by the Colorado, I guess this is the Civil Rights Commission, who's after y'all again, is there anything you can do to make them stop?
So the first case involved the commission. This case actually involves a private plaintiff who's simply taking a case up through the court system. And the answer is, ultimately, the only way to make them stop is to make sure the law is right and to ensure that precedent protects people of faith like Jack Phillips, who simply want to live their lives and hold their beliefs and serve everyone. And so that's our mission. That's why we engage with the culture from a legal perspective primarily, because if the law is right, at very least, that provides a measure of protection. Obviously, the mission of the church and the mission of the broader body of Christ is to change the culture. And we play a small part in that by, through the legal system, ensuring that legal protections are afforded those who are engaged in that mission.
So when you look, Ryan, at the result, the Supreme Court ruling in the Masterpiece Cake Shop case, what else does that provide protections to? Who else is protected as a result of this? I mean, what are the other types of cases? Because the Supreme Court doesn't take up a case like this unless it's something that there are other similarly situated folks. And it's not always going to be a cake maker and gay weddings. Who else would be in this situation?
And really anyone who is being compelled by the government to communicate messages that conflict with that are deeply held religious beliefs. Anytime the government shows hostility towards religion, strong arms individuals into speaking messages that they simply cannot speak in good conscience because of their faith or other conscientious beliefs, I think the Masterpiece decision is very helpful and very useful. But obviously, the fight continues. Jack is still in court in the new case, involving an effort by a private plaintiff this time to coerce his speech. And so these battles have to be continually vigilant and continually willing to engage the fight on these issues.
Jack, it's almost 10 years since those individuals walked into your store and your life was changed, your business was changed. What does this do to a marriage?
Our marriage has gotten stronger. This whole thing is... strengthen the faith of not only myself and my wife and our union, but it's also helped strengthen the faith of my two daughters and my son. And I wrote the book, The Cost of My Faith, so that I could tell this story to my grandkids and my kids and let them know exactly what happened on that July afternoon back in 2012. And we realized, so many times that God is on the throne, that he's in control of all this. You know, he's provided everything we need, and especially the legal help of Alliance Defending Freedom. They're the best in the business, best in our nation, and the only ones really defending, not the only ones, but the ones that defend these things at the highest level more than anybody else. So God has just been so gracious to us and giving us all that we need.
I think people go through life sort of blissfully unaware of how, if someone really wants to tear your life apart, they can use the system to do so, and that there are fewer checks and balances against that than we might immediately expect. Were you surprised that these people, and they're continuing to do it, that activists like this, who have a bee in their bonnet for you, can use the process to do things like this to people? To what extent did that just shock you?
It was surprising, and I graduated high school. I could have told you that there were three branches of government, maybe even been able to name them. But since going through this, I've learned a lot more, and I've come to really appreciate our founding fathers, the way that they designed our Constitution and our executive branch, the legislative branch, all those checks and balances, and the judicial system, so that there is a recourse for somebody like me when somebody like the attorney who's suing me uses it to, weaponize the court system to try and attack not only my faith, but the faith and freedoms of all Americans. And I think the founding fathers would be stunned at the way this has been working itself out. But at the same time, it worked out the way it should the first time. We asked the court to reverse the decision against me, the Supreme Court, and they did. And the second case, the state dismissed it because we knew that they were, again, going to be hostile to me and my faith. And I'm confident that the court will, the ultimate decisions in this case will be the right ones. God will watch over all that as well.
So if they continue to harass, you will be undeterred. You will continue to make cakes, make people happy, and employ your employees and practice your craft.
Mm-hmm. And there will always be people that ask me to create cakes that express messages that I can't, and no one should be forced to express those messages, you know, that go against their conscience. And so hopefully we can fight and defend that, because this isn't just about Jack Phillips and Masterpiece Cake Shop making more cakes. This is about the right of every American to live and work freely according to their conscience, without fear
Jack,
of punishment from
the government. What do you say to people that say to you, and I'm sure they do, I'm glad you did this, because I sure wouldn't have. I would have just made the cake or closed the business. What do you say to those people?
You know, I'm glad we had the opportunity, and again, that we have Alliance Defending Freedom there to protect us, because if it weren't for them, I would have had to close my cake shop, because I wouldn't be able to afford the litigation and all the time and effort. But these rights are worth defending for everybody. So, I would tell them, like I said, my wife and I decided what the cake shop would look like back in the 90s. Before we opened, there were certain things that we knew we could and couldn't create, and those lines haven't changed. And so if we're the ones that are called to defend it, then so be it. We'll do our best. And again, grateful for Alliance Defending Freedom, and people can read about more of the story in The Cost of My Faith, and I hope it's an encouraging story for people who do read it.
That book is out now, The Cost of My Faith, How a Decision in My Cake Shop Took Me to the Supreme Court, where, by the way, he won. And many of you will be protected in the course of your life because he was willing to pay that cost. It's by Jack Phillips. And let me close by asking, because Alliance Defending Freedom had to be there already when he needed them in order to provide the legal representation, because I doubt Jack Phillips or any other or many other individuals could have afforded the legal fees otherwise. So, Ryan, how does somebody help Alliance Defending Freedom real quick, make a contribution?
You bet. Best place to connect with us is adflegal.org, adflegal.org.
Keep up the great work. Thank you, guys.
It's that time. Lock and load. The Michael Vary Show is on the air.
Many times I talk to fascinating guests or interesting people or people who are eyewitnesses to history or have a perspective, or maybe they've just written a book with an interesting story. Sometimes that is because that is news of the day and they offer a unique perspective. Sometimes it's because of a greater trend that they may be able to offer something on, or they seem to know more than anyone else. Sometimes it's a sort of, let's take a step back and look at an issue over a period of time, and they have a unique perspective. Oftentimes it's someone who just puts pen to paper, if people still do that. Maybe they punch a keyboard. And sometimes it's a person with a fascinating life history who also has something interesting to contribute. That would be today's guest, Greg Ellis. I went to IMDb, which is where you go to see what movies and things people have been in, because I knew that he kind of his background was that he'd been all over the movies and TV. He'd done some Broadway, which is kind of, you know, the sort of purest in acting, and video games, toys, movies, TV series, you name it. His IMDb is so long that as I was waiting on him to call in for our interview, I couldn't get to the end of it. So I got to ask you, Greg, because I had to click out of that. So how many movies have you been in? Movies, TV, have you even lost track of it?
Yeah, I don't count, Michael. Thank you for having me on. I have no idea. I know someone counted the video games that I've been a voice on, and I think it's over 120. So, I feel very blessed.
How does one get a gig like that? Because, I can't take a car apart. I can't even change the oil, but I feel like I might be able to do that one.
Well, you know, it's about 18 years ago. I had a manager at the time. He said, you should do voiceover. And I said, what's that? And he said, oh, you can do cartoons and animation and make up voices and act all silly and crazy and like a boy and get paid for it. And I said, oh, I'm game.
So yeah, I'm game. And you'll pay me for it, too?
Right, yeah. It's a good gig. I think it was the philosopher Alan Watts who said, get paid to play. If you can find a job that you play and you get paid for it, then you've cracked it.
You know, I've gotten to know Larry the Cable Guy, and he said of everything he's done, nothing has brought him more notoriety than being the voice of Tomater in the Cars cartoon. And he said, he came to town, and I'm driving him around for the day. He's doing a show for us that night. And I tell my kids, hey, Larry the Cable Guy's coming. And I said, the voice of Tomater. Well, they're 14 and 15. When they were little, Tomater and Cars were, oh, now I want to meet him. Okay, I got it. All right, so the reason we're talking to Greg Ellis is that he has written a book called The Respondent, Exposing the Cartel of Family Law. He's had an interesting life experience, and look, this isn't a woman bashing or a man bashing. This isn't an attempt to get revenge for men against women. It is to look at something that I keep hearing is coming up again and again and again, and maybe it's a problem that needs to be solved. So let's enter the conversation, men and women, with that in mind. Greg, when you named the book The Respondent, Exposing the Cartel of Family Law, I'm kind of getting the impression that you didn't have a good experience in the family law system. Let's start with how that happened.
Yeah, it wasn't great. it was March 5th, 2015. I was, happily married for 20 years, two boys, 8 and 10 years old, the meaning of my life. Love my boys, love being a dad. Most important and meaningful role of my life was being a father. And then suddenly, the cartel, as I call it, the family law, showed up on my doorstep, stole my freedom, and kidnapped my children and murdered my family. I know that sounds like a Hollywood movie trailer for a psychological thriller, but it's actually what happened. I realized on that day, that dystopian day, that I was thrust into the Kafka trap of family law, that I had no rights as an American. And I'm a proud immigrant of America and a citizen here. And I was literally removed from my home in handcuffs, incarcerated, first of five incarcerations, no criminal record, never committed a crime. I've never been arrested, still haven't. And that's what started it all. So I guess, in movie parlance, my reality had pitched and twisted from, the fugitive in The Firm getting gone girled, with David Fincher's The Game. It was just a dark psychological thriller that became real life, and it's a true story. So that's really why I wrote the book, to kind of put my story out there, but also talk about an area of the law that needs reform and needs improving, and this injustice that's been happening to families, parents, and children for decades now, I found out, so that people would feel less alone, but also know how we can change this system.
So who in our audience is going through what you're talking about? Can you be a little more specific?
Yeah, I think anyone who knows someone who has either been through divorce or is going through divorce is stuck in the family law divorce trap. We all have extended family members, brothers, sisters, mothers, sons, daughters, fathers, grandparents. And we're affected. I'm amazed at how many people are affected by this branch of the legal system that doesn't, it doesn't provide a presumption of innocence. That was the staggering thing that I realized, Michael, when I found out that there's no, it's guilty until proven more guilty. It's the one branch of our legal system that doesn't offer that. And that means that criminals get more rights than law-abiding parents and citizens in America. And that's staggering. I didn't think it was like that. The first time I was forced to go to court, 82 hearings I had to attend. I thought, you know what? I'm entering the justice system. This is America, the bastion of justice. And I left America and entered the star chamber of family law. And the nepotism, the collusion between the judges, the attorneys, the state bar associations in particular, who write their own family law code books with no oversight. It's a $60 billion industry that obviously is incentivized not to reform itself.
Why do you think that is? How did it end up there?
I think, that would require a long time to explain, but I think it started with the well-intentioned no-fault divorce laws in the 60s in California. And like much of the legal profession, they can interpret and sometimes often misinterpret the law. And what starts out as a good, well-meaning law can be usurped. And, for example, was in Arizona, you know, equal shared parenting, which should be the norm, which is when someone files for disillusionment of marriage, that two partners or parents share equal time with their kids or kids, 50%. People have been fighting for this for decades. And in Arizona, they passed it, but it said maximize time. Now, that you can interpret maximize parental time, you know, in a myriad of ways. And, you know, currently we have a legal system that is biased. If you look at the statistics, I mentioned this in the book, which is available for pre-order right now, the statistics clearly show there's a bias against fathers. Sometimes mothers get the wrong end of the stick too, but anyone who's thrust into the legal system of family law, it's a zero-sum. We have zero-sum divorce laws, and there's no way out. And it's usually those with the biggest war chest and the biggest propensity to play the victim-perpetrator, as I call it, and make false allegations in a system that puts the burden of proof on the accused rather than the accuser, unlike jurisprudence in Western civilization.
Greg Ellis has written a book called The Respondent, and he argues that men don't get a fair shake in family law, in the family courts. We'll continue our discussion with him about that coming up.
Guitars, cigars, and a few thoughts from the Czar. The Michael Berry Show.
For years, I've been bragging on the team at Allied Outdoor Solutions in Houston for the beautiful work they do to make your outdoor area, your backyard, look like a resort. Well, their business has just grown and grown organically because they do great work. Your walkways, the area around your pool, your outdoor kitchen, all of that. AlliedOutdoorSolutions.com. And now, over the years, it's taken 20 years, they're now in Austin, Dallas, and San Antonio. AlliedOutdoorSolutions.com. 844-846-1010. Call them at 844-846-1010.
I have a buddy named Ray Briers, and he owns a company called The Pipe Yard Inc., INC.com. And if you have a project that needs carbon steel pipe, he stocks everything you need. New surplus, secondary, you name it, rat hole, mouse hole, conductor casing, pipe pile, sign pole, structural, road bores, dredging. If you're buying or selling, you got an abandoned pipeline, wherever, he'll buy it. ThePipeYardInc.com, 409-788-PIPE, 409-788-PIPE.
Greg Ellis is an actor who has been in a lot of different roles. He was on Dexter. He was in Pirates of the Caribbean. He was on 24 and many other things. He's had a storied career in acting, voiceover, toys, games, you name it. But he's written a book called The Respondent about when a man is the respondent to a claim by the mother of his children and how family courts, as he says, are not fair. We talk to him about that now. Greg, you're not just a man being brought into the court system who, granted, in a domestic case like this or family case, is generally going to get short shrift. I mean, you're what we on this side would call Lieutenant Commander Groves from Pirates of the Caribbean, or what on your side you'd say Lieutenant Commander Groves in Pirates of the Caribbean. I mean, you're buddies with Johnny Depp. You were in 24. You're a famous actor. You're telling me that despite all of that, you were still given short shrift and a lack of justice despite the celebrity. I mean,
O.J. Simpson's walking free, not because he's black or white, but because he was famous, right? You're a celebrity, so if it was that bad for you, how bad is it for the average dude?
Oh, it's horrific. And this is, you know, what I mentioned in the book, and this is part of the reason I wrote it. If it can happen to Johnny Depp, and it did in 2016, he became the respondent, which is the name given to the defendant, if you will, in family law. If someone files, they are the plaintiff or petitioner, and if you are the other party, you're the respondent. So it happened to him in 2006. It's happened to Brad Pitt recently. So if it can happen to him, if it can happen to me, it can and it does, and it has been happening to so many fathers. And like I say, mothers too, but predominantly fathers in family law. How are we going to have a Father's Day if there's no fathers left?
That's a pretty deep question. Talk about your relationship with your children throughout this process, because that's the real loser out of this, is these parental relationships, fathers' relationships with their kids.
Yeah, I think, you know, being removed, I was so heavily involved and present in my son's lives. I cut that both their umbilical cords. I was that, you know, the volunteer at both their schools. I coached them at soccer, at baseball. I woke them up in the morning. I read them to sleep at night. I was that dad. It was, you know, I was a great father, and to be removed from their lives, and more importantly, for them to have a father removed from their lives at such a tender age, as their psychologies are growing and they're learning through adolescence, and they need that mentorship of dad, and that connection to dad, and that trust and safety and security, was devastating for them, and devastating to me and for me. And look, my story is just one of many. It's a cautionary tale, you know, the respondent, but it's to highlight what's going on in family law. You know, the book is part memoir, part meditation, and part manifesto, and it's a portrait of what I believe is the most misunderstood aspect of the American legal system. It's part guidebook, hopefully an indispensable read for parents, mothers, and fathers enduring the grief or the living grief of child separation. But anyone interested in learning about the overreach and unrelenting brutality of family law, it's a true story. You know, family breakdown, I think, is the single greatest threat to American society. Every day, every single day, more than 4,000 children lose a parent because of our archaic and inhumane family court system. Think about that, 4,000 children. And the effects on our collective community mental health, particularly men's mental health, is very disturbing, particularly at a time where we're told to socially distance. We shouldn't be told to socially distance. We should be socially connected. Physical distancing, yes. Socially connected, absolutely. And with social isolation, and what's happened with COVID, it's no wonder that even before this, every day, 10 divorced men took their own lives, and now 1 in 3 children in our country are without their father, and those numbers are increasing. Why is America the world leader in so many great things, but it's the world leader in single-parent families? We have a fatherless crisis on our hands, and dad-deprived boys. And when we have a state-sanctioned and a legal system that perpetrates this, because it's a $60 billion a year, I call it the American divorce machine, it doesn't answer to the Supreme Court. It's needlessly adversarial. It promotes an uncivil war that the unwitting participants are powerless to stop. And, you know, it's the one area of our legal system where justice is not blind. Courts presiding over divorce and child custody are not neutral, and abuses of power shielded by judicial immunity are not often checked, and no one is held accountable. So in my book, I'm doing many things, but one thing I'm trying to do is expose this state-sanctioned Armageddon for children.
You've used the term American to narrow the scope of what you were talking about. Is this not an international problem? If I cross the Atlantic, is this a British problem? Or do we see this elsewhere? To what extent is this distinctly American?
Well, I live in America. I'm an American citizen. I love America. I'm a patriot. This land of the free and the home of the brave has given me many opportunities. I will stand up and speak to the many positive aspects of America. But yes, it's happening in the UK, it's happening in Europe, it's happening in Canada, South America. This is an issue that has been, I was unaware until it happened to me, but it's been going on for decades now. And, too often, I think, these tools that are built in the legal system, that they've become weaponized, you know, shields for women, which, you know, and women need protection. They need to, our wonderful mothers and women need to have protection from the law. Domestic violence is very serious. Should be tried in criminal court. Right now it's not tried in criminal court. It's tried in the quasi-kangaroo courts of family law. We need.
You
to
think
hold,
it would be better if tried in criminal court?
Yes, absolutely. Violence is very serious. I mean, you know, particularly domestic violence, and it should be tried in criminal court. And the irony is, of course, you know, I spoke to a father who 20-something years ago was sitting before a judge in family law accused, falsely accused of domestic violence, and he lifted his hands up with his wrists and said, Your Honor, please instruct the bailiff to arrest me. If I'm to be accused of a criminal offense, I should be arrested. And, of course, what he was doing, ironically, was saying, I'll get more rights if I'm arrested as a criminal. I get my Miranda rights. I get to speak to an attorney. All of that which we give to pedophiles, terrorists, rapists, and murderers, we don't give to families and parents and by de facto children. So absolutely, violence is very serious. And you know, the false allegations, which I call it the silver bullet. I mentioned it in my book, the six silver bullets of high conflict divorce and the magic ballistics of family law. They are being used and weaponized by nefarious people. The attorneys, the judges who used to be attorneys, to basically churn and propagate the acrimony and keep it going. And there really is no escape. That's the most disturbing thing. People who are thrust into the cauldron of family law, it becomes this inescapable, unrelenting trauma where the attorneys hold all the cards, because there's no guilt or innocence. It's just this kind of middle ground of guilty till proven more guilty, similar to what's going on in cancel culture right now.
Greg Ellis has written a book called The Respondent about when men are called into court by a woman with whom they share children, and he says the system is a cartel stacked against men. We'll talk more about that coming up. I'm so tired of being
alone. The only way to social distance.
I'm not leaving my house.
You're quarantining with The Michael Berry Show.
We have to quarantine ourselves.
This is Dad Life. Check me. Gas station glasses. Don't care what the masses think about me with my sweet goatee. I'm rocking my Dockers with a cuff and a crease. I got that St. John's Bay and the clip for my piece. I look nice. I got dozens of dollars and that's right. It goes straight to my daughters and my wife. I'm a miracle dad, making magic with the checkbook is a talent I have. I roll hard in the yard with a 60-inch cut. Zero turn radius, my neighbors say, what? They be driving by, peeping my landscape. Yo, these greens got nothing on my manscape. Hydrangeas, what? Begonias, no. Crepe myrtles,
ornamental turtles.
Hold up. Is that a weed in my fescue?
The book is The Respondent by Greg Ellis. He's a very famous actor, been in a lot of movies you've seen. But in this capacity, he's a dad, a father, who ended up in family law court, where he says the family law system is a cartel stacked against dads. I want to move to cancel culture because I know you've talked about that. But before we do, your experience in family law. You know, obviously you never would have, when you're cutting your child's umbilical cord, you never expect to be in a courtroom fighting over custody and all those sorts of things. To what extent, I've not read the book, which is The Respondent, a true story exposing the cartel of family law with an introduction by Johnny Depp. It will be available the 29th of this month, and it's available for pre-order now. But talk a little bit about to what extent, I mean, to what extent is the court really a cudgel by which, I don't know your case with your ex, but I'm assuming it had to be pretty rancorous to end up there. Because I've seen these cases where a mean-spirited woman can do this to a man and run them through the ringer, and their love of their children is something she uses against them, not just to poison the kids against him, but to use the court to sort of punish him because he found another woman, or he didn't love her anymore, or she grew out of favor with him, or he didn't measure up to what she wanted to be. To what extent did that happen to you?
A great extent. I mean, it's called parental alienation. It's something that the World Health Organization in 2019 finally designated as a mental health disorder. You know, I've seen too many, I've read too many suicide notes from fathers, good men, loving men, some mothers too, but mainly fathers. You know, and these false allegations that are used to thwart the non-resident parent, as the terminology goes, and the child relationship need to be dealt with in a way that protects the relationship that's under attack and in a way to dissuade the making of these accusations going forward. You know, too many times children are used as weapons. And, you know, there's an old aphorism that if there's anything that we wish to change in our children, we first examine it and see whether it is not something that could better be changed in ourselves. So this one area of family law, which is parental alienation, is misunderstood, particularly by the experts in the system. It's psychological child abuse, plain and simple. It's brainwashing. And currently, fathers have no legal redress whatsoever. And, you know, when you look at the evidence, you look at the statistics, demonizing fatherhood is not the solution. It's the problem. Demonizing masculinity is not the solution. It's the problem. We really need to start having a Me Too dialogue rather than a Me Too monologue. And men should be involved in that conversation, not be afraid to speak up. I don't come from an angry or a bitter place. I love women. Where would we be without women and mothers and grandmothers and sisters and aunts and daughters, strong, nurturing women? But there are some nefarious people out there. And victimhood, I think, has become the new social currency, and its economy is booming.
You're exactly right. It's gone from a cottage industry to mainstream. And I think this has happened with a lot of things. I think we went from a situation of domestic, you know, men beating their wives and officers showing up and leaving and he does it some more, to now when they show up, somebody has to be arrested. Cops tell me when they show up and there was a call made, somebody has to be arrested. And it's almost always going to be him. And then we later find out that actually she was knocking the snot out of him, or, you know, there's a lot of things that go into these sorts of things. But the point is, the overreaction does not cure that which went wrong in the first place. And that's true in cancel culture. That's true in, you know, this supposed bullying. Somebody is thought to be bullying someone because they disagree with them, so they have to be canceled in Hollywood or wherever else. It's got to be tough for a guy like you who speaks out against a lot of these trends, and yet you still make your living, you know, doing voiceovers and characters. It puts you at a greater risk, right?
Well, it does, but, well, it's relative, isn't it? I think about the family, you know, in Wisconsin or Texas or Maine or Portland or Tennessee. You know, I think about the hardworking men out there who are grafting and grinding to make a living for their families and put food on the table. And it's hard enough to get through the day for them. And then they're thrust into this system. I mean, you know, you mentioned domestic violence. You know, one of the misnomers is put forth by the domestic violence lobbying groups. You know, domestic violence rates have been declining for decades. If you look at the U.S. Department of Justice statistics, the rates of serious intimate partner violence against women fell by 72% between 1994 and 2011. And when you actually speak to the people who've been working in this field, in this area, for decades, someone like Aaron Pizzi, who started the world's first shelter, a domestic violence shelter, 52 years ago, what she found after a couple of years that many, not most, and not all, but many of the women that were coming into her shelter were actually perpetrating violence themselves. So she talked about that. And she had her cat poisoned and killed. She had a bomb sent to her house. The bomb squad came, and she was hounded out of England. Because that narrative or the statistics she was putting forth, which were just her experience, you know, we don't talk about that. You know, we don't talk about the fact that there are bad women out there. It's just bad men. And, you know, the truth is there are good women and there are good men and there are bad women and bad men. And we should be allowed to talk about the fact that mothers kill their children at about the same rate as fathers. You know, it's a harrowing statistic, but it's true.
Greg Ellis is a famous actor from 24, Pirates of the Caribbean, Dexter, and lots of other things. But today, he's talking about what it's like as a father in family court, where he says men don't get a fair shake. That's what we're talking about. We'll continue.
What are we going to do?
Keep calm and listen on.
Don't you turn it off!
It's how we do it around here. This is the Michael Berry Show.
You know, it's almost as if Greg Ellis is our guest. The book is The Respondent. It's almost as if we can't be reasonable. We have to lurch from inactivity to overactivity. I'll give you a one that doesn't get talked about as much anymore. But years ago, there was a problem in America with people getting behind the wheel so drunk they were passing out while driving. And the numbers were staggering how many people would be killed by these people who were so drunk that they were killing others, not as often themselves, because oddly enough, you often survive drunk driving if you're the drunk, but killing people. So Mothers Against Drunk Driving goes on this big push, and they get the judges to start throwing the book at them. And then it became the case that if you practically have a drink, you're getting a DWI. And even the founder of MAD has now come out and said, we went too far. We're criminalizing too many people who are not drunk. They're blowing hot, but hot is too low a number. So again, it's just this pendulum swinging with these overreactions, when a justice system should be able to look at each case individually. And as you said, women are not all good or bad, and men are not all good or bad, and we can do better. You know, you talked about masculinity, yeah, and that some of what you're talking about with men in the family court system is a sort of anti-masculinity. I truly believe there are some people who don't see a role for the man in the household. And you see it. You see it publicly. You see some people, particularly angry women, maybe they had a bad relationship, maybe they don't like men, whatever their issue, and they have this sort of anti-man mentality. Well, that's not healthy either. And I think that is probably more widespread than we would expect. I'm not saying that's 90% of people. It may be 8%, and you thought it was 4%.
Yeah, well, you know, circling back for a moment to what you said about police being, or law enforcement being called out, they used to have discretion to make judgment calls with domestic violence calls, and now they don't have discretion. Someone must be removed from the home, and that's more often than not the father and not the mother, or the male and not the female. And, you know, when you talk about masculinity, look, with men, fathers, boys, and males bombarded by messages recently about the deeply corrosive effects of toxic masculinity, we're confronted with institutions now psychologically conditioned to think that masculinity, the very idea of men, is toxic, that man's kindness is extinct, chivalry is a bygone notion. And you know, we need the stoic, physical, traditional, masculine, mythopoetic male in our society who will fight the wars, who will do the hard labor. It's not misogynistic of me to suggest that if I'm in a burning building, I want the strongest person, the bravest person in that moment to rush in and save me. I don't care the race, nationality, sex, right, religion of that individual. I want the most qualified pilot to land the plane if there's a problem. You know, this is part of what we're facing right now with masculinity, with these messages, and it's particularly, I think I'm particularly disturbed about what we're saying to our younger generation of boys and younger men. and what they are thinking. You know, the devaluation of the male. It's really not a good thing to be propagating that kind of nonsense. And you know, conversely, I don't think the argument to demonize, you know, if we're going to have a conversation about toxic masculinity, well, shouldn't we have a conversation about toxic femininity? Isn't that equality? If we're going to be passing laws, like, you know, President Biden on his first day, the executive order on gender equality, said, you know, equality for all peoples. It should have been a period after that, but he didn't. It was dash, particularly women and girls. The domestic violence bill in the UK that was going through the House of Parliament and the House of Lords. It was a domestic violence bill for women and girls. Well, that just suggests that boys and men can't be victims of domestic violence. Well, that bill and that law has no protection for baby boys, for teenage boys, for homosexual boys and men, for non-binary. I mean, we're in this preposterous upside down, Michael, where those who are purporting to be the good people and want equality really don't understand there's a difference between equality of outcome and equality of opportunity.
Okay, I promised my producer I wouldn't go completely fanboy about what I'm about to ask you, but I did wait until the very end so as not to distract you from the purpose of a very serious book and a serious issue. But I was something of a Dexter fanboy par excellence, extraordinaire. You played Jonathan Farrow, I think it was season 4. You're the only person to my knowledge that is considered innocent, although the character is a rapist, but he didn't commit the murder Dexter thought he did. Could I just have 60 to 90 seconds or however long you feel comfortable talking about what it was like being on that show? Because I loved it.
It was great. Coincidentally, it's coming back. I was just talking with the director this morning. A friend of mine, Clancy Brown, is on the new incarnation of Dexter. Yeah, it was a wonderful experience. You know, I don't recommend being naked and having your head chopped off by Michael C. Hall. But I had little idea of the cult following and success of the show when I was asked to do it. And it was really interesting to play play an innocent, or I believe the only innocent victim of the crime that Dexter killed me for, or killed my character for, I should say. Great experience. Good cast.
What was that
crew,
set like? Because it's pretty pretty dark subjects, right? What was that subject like? Because you know he's you know you have two cast members playing brother and sister, and they're married in a pretty intense relationship, and then I think they're separated as the filming's going on. That had to create a pretty fascinating environment.
Yeah, it was. I remember there were moments, I'd say, of lighthearted banter. I remember one particular definitive moment, if you will, was I was in my trailer rehearsing my next scene, which was the scene where I was going to be naked, laying on a slab, pleading for my life, and the door of my trailer swung open, and John Lithgow walked in, and he's like, "Oh my, I'm in the wrong trailer," or it's fine. So I, you know, put a robe on because I was lying on the floor rehearsing, and we sat down, had a cup of tea, and just chatted for a while, and you know, and then we're on set, and I'm getting my head chopped off by Michael C. Hall. You know, that's part and parcel of.
It's pretty heady stuff, pun intended.
Right. Very good.
But Greg, I got to say, my takeaway from that story is that if John Lithgow's trailer could be confused by him for yours, then you either had a really, really nice trailer or you're pretty well respected in that cast, because that's a superstar.
I don't know. I think the trailers look the same. I mean, many of them are, you know, they're white and, you know, he's probably
boring.
Busy looking at his lines and then sees a door and they're all next to each other.
I'm looking forward to reading the book. It will be out the 29th. You can pre-order it now. It's called The Respondent. And I'll send you an email with my personal review. Thank you for your time, sir. I appreciate it.
You're very welcome, Michael. Thank you. You have a wonderful day. Keep up the great work.
Ladies and gentlemen, Elvis has... has left the building. Thank you and good night.
My big health focus has been drink more water, get basic exercise, reduce your stress, and perhaps most important, better sleep and more sleep. You don't want to lay in bed where you can't sleep. I use thetrustedlab.com. Thetrustedlab.com comes directly to your home. I don't want to be involved with addictive drugs and medicine and all that. Completely healthy, completely natural, and I get results. Thetrustedlab.com.